You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
For over 70 years, Littleton has been helping people just like you sell coins and currency. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. The process is incredibly simple. Visit littletoncoin.com/majority to learn more.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 7th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, lecturer from Dartmouth University, historian Mark Bray, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Also on the program today, Trump makes a debt ceiling deal with Nancy and Chuck. Meanwhile, Irma destroys a part of the Caribbean, pounds Puerto Rico, Florida could be next. John McCain, meanwhile, may revive the Affordable Care Act, repeal and replace. Gary Cohn gets his just desserts, a crap souffle. Al Franken plays hardball on judges, and Steve Bannon has got a new old bone to chew on.
And his something name to do with immigrants.
That's his old bone that he's chewing on. His new old bone is Paul Ryan. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Some craziness yesterday in terms of a debt ceiling deal. When we left the air yesterday, September looked like it was going to be a real crap show. We were facing a debt ceiling that it appeared might be crashed through on September 30th. A budget that needed to be submitted and passed. Reauthorization for the FAA, reauthorization for the National Insurance Flood Insurance Program, for the Children's Health Program. And it appears yesterday what happened was this got punted for 3 months. Hurricane Harvey relief will pass, at least parts of it. And the debt ceiling was punted for 3 months, as is the budget. And it brings up an interesting dynamic here to see Trump make a deal with the Democrats. He completely pulled the rug out underneath from Paul Ryan in a fantastic, stunning way. We will play some clips from Paul Ryan to sort of show that. But here is Donald Trump just talking about the deal that he made with Nancy and Chuck.
Say to those who say there are mixed signals coming from the White House over DACA.
No mixed signal at all. Congress, I really believe, wants to take care of the situation. Really believe it. Even very conservative members of Congress, I've seen it firsthand. If they don't, we're going to see what we're going to do. But I will tell you, I really believe Congress wants to take care of it. We discussed that also today. And Chuck and Nancy would like to see something happen, and so do I. And I said, if we can get something to happen, we're going to sign it, and we're going to make it, a lot of happy people.
Now, of course, Donald Trump's full of crap, but the point is, there is some who are upset at Pelosi and Schumer for not including DACA in this deal and not trusting Donald Trump. And I don't think they should trust Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump has a clue. In 3 days, he could have a totally different perspective on this. But at the moment, it appears that this deal has happened. And I will discuss the relative merits of it as the show goes on. But it is quite a turn of events here. So, and the biggest loser, at least in the short term, and perhaps in the midterm, is Paul Ryan, which I'm quite happy about, I have to say. Here is, so Paul Ryan, and we should say, just before we do this clip, and I want to play this clip here, but Steve Bannon is meeting with the Freedom Caucus folks. And there's a story about how he met with them yesterday, and they went over to chastise Paul Ryan after they had met with Bannon. Paul Ryan thought that he had a deal with President Trump. And the deal, the plan was this. They were going to send a Harvey relief bill, or I should say an 18-month passage of the debt ceiling to the Senate. Now, 18 months, if you can do your math, puts you well beyond the 2018 election. If the Democrats end up taking Congress, then they're going to have to deal with getting votes for the debt ceiling. If it's the Republicans, there's no price for them to pay if they extract some, I don't know what they would want to pass the debt ceiling, but 18 months out is comfortably past the 2018 election. And of course, Paul Ryan doesn't want to deal with this. So the idea was we send 18 month, it passes the Senate. It comes to the House. Paul Ryan attaches the Harvey relief to it. Then everybody's compelled to vote for it and they all have cover. And if that's what the president wants, then they got double cover, right? Because a lot of these people live in states and districts where Donald Trump is still popular. 24 hours ago, Donald Trump signs off on this. We'll play the clip of Paul Ryan talking about how disgusting it would be if the Democrats even contemplated the idea of 3 months. Meaning that we couldn't just get rid of the debt ceiling as an issue. And then hours later, he was screwed over. But then he's going to take some hits from Lou Dobbs, who is defining Republicanism as Donald Trump, as opposed to where all the Republicans want to talk about how Republicanism is not Donald Trump. I enjoyed this.
A few thoughts now on the death of a rhino. Nothing to lament here. We're just examining politics in 2017. I'm talking about Speaker Paul Ryan and his obsequious deference to corporate lobbyists, his unbridled hostility toward President Trump. The president not only took Rhino Ryan to the woodshed, but eliminated any need for any Republican to ever pretend again that Ryan is a real Republican in any way, or that any rhino has a political future after Mr. Trump simply booted the hapless fool of a speaker out of the way of those trying to get the nation's business done. Here's the clueless Ryan just this morning talking about a proposal tying Harvey funding to an increase in the debt ceiling.
What the leaders you just described proposed is unworkable. I think that's ridiculous and disgraceful that they want to play politics with the debt ceiling at this moment. I think that's a ridiculous idea. I hope that they don't mean that.
They did mean that. And it wasn't so ridiculous, it turns out, because within just a few hours, President Trump reached a deal with the Democrats to raise the debt limit to fund the government until mid-December while providing funds for Harvey relief. Deal done. President Trump also clearing the way for tax reform while he was at it. Contrast Ryan's inane insults, his obstinance and subversion of President Trump to the behavior and the rhetoric of Democratic leadership of late. They've calmed themselves. They've been far more conciliatory in their rhetoric over recent weeks. And now Ryan is fully exposed to the nation. His Congress, one that has accomplished next to nothing this year. Nothing in Paul Ryan's nearly 2-year tenure as a speaker has been done.
First of all, I love that clip because Ryan's taken to the woodshed as a Rhino Ryan. And I love that because Lou Dobbs apparently doesn't own a television. Up until 24 hours ago, Democrats were still talking about Donald Trump as a fascist apologist.
And but then they calmed down. Now it's Ryan O'Ryan.
They calmed down. Now it's Chuck.
Now it's Ryan Buddy O'Ryan. Chuck. Friendly, Buddy Chuck. Friendly Nancy. My new friends and Ryan O'Ryan. I would just like
Nicey
to say
Nicey Nancy. That's what I call it.
Nicey Nancy. Because you know what? Because she's a good person.
Chummy Chuck.
Chummy Chuck.
Chummy Chuck. Nicey Nancy.
Soft spot for the Jews. I would just like.
And the high ties.
And the, oh, always the high ties. Great guys. That clip was a tough stuff and a strong signal.
Oh, yeah.
That was Tommy Lauren copy. The way that he used adjectives.
Yes, like, yes. He's like, I'm not getting shown the door.
No.
Yeah, let me show this young lady how it's done. I've been doing white nationalism before it was trendy.
That's
God
right.
Damn it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mark Bray on Antifa, the anti-fascist handbook. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Mark Bray, a lecturer in the history department at Dartmouth University, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
And let me just say that as I slip back into Antifa, please forgive me because I just... It's my Massachusetts accent that takes over when I see that A.
And that's fine. Go ahead.
All right. Well, let's start with this. Let's start with the history of anti-fascism as, I mean, I guess, is this a phenomena or do you define it as a group, an ideology? Let's start with that. And then I guess we go to the history.
Sure. In general, I would say it's sort of an activity or a politics. It's a way of looking at opposition to fascism through a sort of pan-radical left lens. It's not one specific group. That's sort of a mistake that the media often makes. It's a way of doing politics to oppose the far right. Anyone can form their own group. There is no sort of an Antifa central command. And historically, it goes back a century. We can see the earliest anti-fascists, you know, started struggling against Mussolini's black shirts in Italy, Hitler's brown shirts in Germany. They journeyed from around the world to fight in the Spanish Civil War and the international brigades. But what's sort of harder for people to understand is that after World War II, although the Axis powers were defeated, in Europe, the sort of sleeping dragon of fascism was slumbering and has reemerged, most notably in the 70s and 80s in Britain and Germany, when a kind of neo-Nazi skinhead wave targeted immigrants from South Asia, from the Caribbean and elsewhere, leftists, and these Antifa groups organized to fight back against the far right. And that spread to the United States in the form of anti-racist action in the 80s and 90s. And that's the kind of lineage and trajectory that we can trace to Antifa today in the U.S.
Why? What was it? I mean, where was it in the United States before the 1980s?
Well, so certainly we can see it in the 20s and 30s and 40s. There were struggles in Italian-American communities, German-American communities. There were Jewish self-defense organizations that were waging these kinds of struggles in the U.S. as the main fight was going on in Europe. We can also see, of course, that if we take a step back and look at anti-fascism as really just one facet of a larger historical struggle against white supremacy, that we can see certainly that African-American struggles against the Klan and against other white supremacist formations in the U.S. go back centuries. Even in the 60s and 70s, there were black and Latino self-defense groups. In the 80s, we can see the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was another kind of formation. But in terms of the kind of lineage of the European-style Antifa, we can really see its emergence in the U.S. in the late 80s with anti-racist action.
Is it also defined by the notion that the agenda of anti-fascism supersedes any other political agenda of, I guess, I mean, is that an element of this? And if it is that a temporal element?
So part of the politics derives from lessons that anti-fascists have derived from history. So if you look at the historical anti-fascists of the 20s and 30s, it was very hard for socialists and communists and anarchists to get on the same page. Moments when they were on the same page were fleeting. We can see in Italy, the Arditi del Popolo was a pan-left anti-fascist militia that after a little while, the communists left and the socialists left. Same thing with the Spanish Civil War. The left unity was very temporal. So in the post-war period, a lot of leftists have said, look, you know, we have a lot of differences of opinion about politics, but when it comes to this common threat, let's take a hint from history and put those things aside to organize together against it. And that's something that's sort of maybe the most important point to take out of all of this, I think, for listeners, is you may disagree with what these people do, but let's try to find a way maybe to get on the same page and push against a common enemy. And so in that sense, you're right that it's a pan-left politics that tries to put other issues aside for the moment, not permanently, and certainly there's still a lot of differences, but that's where it's coming from.
So theoretically, I could be a liberal or I could be an anarchist, and we could both go out and be engaging in Antifa, I guess, expressions.
Sure. I mean, I've spoken to members of Antifa groups who say that they have members well across the political spectrum. Most certainly are some sort of socialist, but I've spoken to groups that say they also have more centrist people, liberals, social democrats, a whole wide range. And even if people aren't comfortable with sort of the Antifa aesthetic or mode of politics, certainly I think that we're seeing a really inspiring anti-racist movement broadly conceived growing. And that is really, I think, the main story that sometimes gets overshadowed in these conversations.
Well, yeah, I mean, so what is the difference between Antifa and anti-racism, broadly speaking? I mean, how do we make that distinction? When you went out to look for, and maybe you should also talk about your methodology a little bit, but when you went out to basically get data for this book, I mean, how do you know that you're talking to an Antifa or an anti-racist, I guess, activist?
So the way I went about doing this, and to take a step back, part of the reason why books like this have not been written really previously is that most Antifa are very reticent to speak to the media, speak to academics, to share their identity. They're very concerned about their groups being infiltrated or being doxxed by the far right or having their information known to authorities. So I'm a longtime activist. I was involved with Occupy Wall Street. I actually came on your show 6 years ago to talk about Occupy Wall Street. And so I have connections in different left networks, and I know some people who are part of some of these groups. I spoke to them. I asked them for references to put me in touch with people they work with. And so sort of working through those networks, I managed to speak to more than 60 current and former anti-fascists from 17 different countries. And in that way, I try to paint a broad picture. Now, what is the difference between sort of anti-fascism or Antifa and anti-racism more broadly? Well, the lines are not always entirely clear, and that's really true of politics in general, is that lines are often blurry. Nevertheless, what I focused on is trying to trace the lineage of the sort of specifically Antifa form of politics in Europe, and I focused on people who self-defined in that way. So really, I don't think that it's a matter of drawing firm boundaries. I didn't include all anti-racist groups because not all anti-racist groups would define themselves that way. I really tried to look at how groups define themselves and focus on those kind of Antifa-style groups that emphasize values such as no platform for fascism, have direct action methods, and so forth.
I was going to ask you if we were down in if we had talked in Zuccotti at that time, but that's interesting. I mean, that delineation. So is there a positive, like a proactive agenda to Antifa? Because, you know, for instance, Black Lives Matter, which you would say is a, you know, at the very least, an anti-white supremacy group, also comes out with a set of policy statements that are very proactive, right? I mean, there are issue sets that they want that are beyond or are part of, I guess, degrading white supremacy in this country. Is there anything analogous to that within Antifa, or is it just simply defined as getting rid of fascists?
So there's sort of a range of perspectives among anti-fascist groups, both in North America and Europe. Some focus more on organizing in communities, trying to inoculate people who might potentially be sympathetic to a sort of fascist or white supremacist message, inoculate them against those messages, promote anti-racist propaganda, try to organize sometimes through the labor movement. So in the U.S., we could see, for example, the General Defense Committees of the Industrial Workers of the World Labor Union are essentially labor-oriented, mass, anti-racist, anti-fascist formations that don't cover their faces and don't operate in the exact same way as Antifa groups. And then there are groups who focus more on trying to short-circuit the advance of white supremacist organizing. And then there's sort of a range in between. In countries like Spain or France, there are Antifa assemblies where people from different unions and community groups kind of come together and share resources. Some of them are sort of what we would say is more explicitly Antifa groups that participate. Others are not. So there's sort of a range of perspectives, but it all kind of comes back to the point that different leftists will sort of disagree about policy prescriptions, about what the future should look like. But to some extent, those are put aside in this struggle. And that's why it sort of comes across sometimes as more of a reactive politics, a politics of self-defense. But certainly, you know, fascism grows when people's needs are not being met, when they're desperate. And we can see that historically with the Great Depression. We can see it with the rise of the far right in Europe after the financial crisis of 2008. So part of it is sort of advancing the left. Part of it is short-circuiting the far right. And then there's perspectives in between.
Are there major tactical differences within those who self-identify as Antifa?
There are. I mean, before even getting into that, one thing to clarify is what sort of differentiates Antifa from what the Europeans call the anti-racist movement or from a kind of official governmental anti-fascism of states like Germany or Italy is that they disagree with pursuing legislative bans on hate speech or the far right. They're a direct action-oriented politics. That having been said, within the kind of milieu, there are some that focus more on mass organizing, some that focus more on confrontation. But generally speaking, the groups that I've spoke to, the individuals I spoke to, really emphasize that each location, each context requires its own responses. Most of what anti-fascists do is what we would call nonviolent organizing, researching the far right, exposing who these people are, what kinds of social media networks they work through, contacting venues to cancel conferences at hotels or white power skinhead punk shows at VFWs or American Legions. And in that way, it's very contextual. I spoke to some groups, for example, in Denmark in the 1990s, one of the most common tactics was calling the parents of young skinheads and telling them what they were up to try and, you know, make it so they couldn't go out of the house anymore. So it is very contextual, and how they do it varies. I spoke to a Norwegian who said in Norway the anti-fascists really emphasized forming coalitions with unions and political parties to make a really broad front against fascism. Some of the Swedes I spoke to disagreed with that. So there are differences of opinion.
From a taxonomy perspective, what is black box tactics and Antifa tactics? I mean, just give me the sense of the taxonomy there.
Sure. So the black box, for listeners who are unfamiliar, is essentially a tactic, not a specific group. There is no specific black box. Any group of people could form one by simply dressing uniformly in black, covering their faces. And the idea is that's a way for groups of people to carry out militant direct actions without being identified. It grew out of the autonomous movement of Germany in the 1980s and was used to defend squats, to also fight back against a really virulent neo-Nazi skinhead wave that emerged after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So if you'd have a few thousand neo-Nazis celebrating the birthday of Hitler, German anti-fascists would form a black bloc to confront them. It's since spread around the world largely in the anarchist movement. It can be used for any kind of political context. Probably the most famous use of it in the U.S. was the Battle of Seattle in 1999, the protests against the World Trade Organization. A lot of anti-fascists will use this tactic, but plenty will not. I spoke to British anti-fascists who said that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, they preferred to dress in casuals, which is sort of your kind of typical kind of football hooligan type look, so that the police couldn't tell if they were fascist or anti-fascist or football fans or what have you. So it depends on the context. You know, a lot of anti-fascists will use a black bloc, but it's not synonymous. People can use black blocs for anything, and it's certainly not the best option for every political situation, and not all anti-fascists use it.
So black bloc is a tactic, and anti-fascism is almost a strategy, yes?
Yep, sure, you could say that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and because it's amazing to me how much license is taken with just these terms, and generally as a way of by way of smearing, groups of people in protests.
Right, and that's been one of the most astounding things is how much journalists and politicians and pundits are willing to say while knowing so little, and. In writing my book, I was addressing articles that came out after the various anti-fascist protests that have burst into the headlines over the past 6 months or so, and arguments about what anti-fascism leads to, arguments about what shutting down the far right inevitably produces, are almost always just grounded in analytical speculation and treat anti-fascism as if it's kind of a thought experiment that some crazy kids came up with, rather than a fairly well-defined political strategy, agree with it or disagree with it, that has developed over the course of decades in multiple countries.
Right. The point being is that we have data. We don't have to speculate whether or not there's a slippery slope. We can look back to history to see if one gets created in these instances.
Right. And the pattern that I found, which I think is really interesting and is almost never mentioned or looked into, is that if you interview an anti-fascist who has a local group, you ask them, why did your group form when it formed? Well, they'll usually say there was a local neo-Nazi skinhead group, or there was this anti-Semitic group passing out this information. So we formed a group to stop them. Okay, your group lasted for 4 years. Why did it stop? Well, it stopped because the local fascist group stopped organizing and everyone went back to being environmentalists or trade unionists or what have you. So the lifespan of these groups is almost always directly linked to the rise and fall of the far right. It's a defensive activity that was true back in the 20s and 30s. It's true today. So the notion that when the local fascist or far-right group is stopped, that anti-fascists will inevitably start shutting down, you know, anyone they quote-unquote disagree with is just, I've never come across that happening. So, and we have decades of data across multiple countries. So it's not a speculation that's really informed by information.
I mean, I guess the hard part, I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, I mean, obviously the agenda is to get rid of the fascists or to to disrupt their organizing, to quash them, to nip them in the bud before they get increase in power and in numbers and whatnot. And I guess on a local level, it's sort of easier to tell if you've been successful. But how much coordination is there, let's say, nationally in this country? How much is that group in that anti-fascist group in Illinois? How much of its processes and its vetting, let's say, and its organizational structure, to the extent that there is one, how similar is that to one in Oakland or in, let's say, North Carolina?
Sure. So one thing to point out is that there is a national network called the Torch Network that has about a dozen groups affiliated, and they share resources and information and so forth. And so I would imagine that they coordinate more than your average Antifa group. Some groups shared information about their vetting methods for new members. Others did not. I know some groups simply don't accept new members. Others go through an extensive background check process. Certainly, if there's a local white supremacist leader who moves from one city to another, often the group from the original city will notify the new city that they should keep an eye on this new person. So it depends. There is coordination, but a lot of it really grows out of local circumstances and local perspectives. And so there's similarities but differences. And the thing is, a lot of this information, a lot of the answer probably will never really be made public because these groups tend to be not very open.
And they're not open because both of concerns about state action, but also concerns of fascist action.
Right, right. So, I mean, for example, I spoke to a prominent Danish anti-fascist named Rasmus Preston, who made the unorthodox decision of making his identity and his work entirely public. And he was assaulted 4 or 5 times in the course of about 18 months. He got numerous threats. This is the kind of thing that people are concerned about if you have a family and a job. And many of the people that I spoke to have really a wide range of jobs, from nurses to teachers to clerks to grocery store workers. And they just don't want to deal with all of that in their personal life. And also they don't want groups to be infiltrated because that has happened in both directions. And it's a risky business. It's not something that people enter into lightly. All of the anti-fascists I spoke to would much rather this not be a problem. They'd rather spend their time on, more productive kinds of political activity to build a better world. But it is a threat, and they take it seriously.
What is the value of them identifying as Antifa? I mean,
That's an interesting point because, especially now that the term has gained a lot of common misconceptions and a lot of negativity, frankly. I know that there are some groups who don't use the term to avoid that. And we could even see early on the decision by Anti-Racist Action in the 80s and 90s, which modeled itself on the British Anti-Fascist Action, but chose the language of anti-racism in part because they felt like it fit better in the American context, that you don't have to call yourself this, you don't have to use the word. It started being used more in the U.S. in the late 2000s, so the oldest currently existing Antifa group in the U.S. is Rose City Antifa in Portland, Oregon, and they chose it in part because they had some European members, in part because they wanted to have a closer connection to the European movement. Part of it has to do with that kind of aesthetic, that transnational aesthetic. But certainly in the future, groups will choose carefully whether to use a name or not, because especially if a group wants to be more open and have their identities more public and do more mass work, it may not be a useful term to use. So those are all things to be taken into account, for sure.
You write in the book that those people who adopt an Antifa, I guess, agenda, it's a function of them not having what you say most people have, which is an all or nothing view of fascism. Tease that out for us.
Sure. So, a lot of what we've heard is a sort of normal prescription for dealing with these far-right groups is just ignore them, because the argument goes that the ridiculous nature of their politics, the hateful nature of what they're espousing will make itself evident, and there's no way they'll become mass movements. Now, often that's true, right? We can see most of the time these small far-right groups don't expand into mass movements. Sometimes they do. But the point is not whether or not these groups will become mass movements or whether these groups will become regimes. That's part of it, but that's not all of it. The other part of it is even in small doses, these groups can be dangerous. And we saw that with the murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville. We've seen it with, even recently there was an arson attack on an Iraqi business in Arizona. And that rather than seeing fascism and white supremacy as either you have Hitler in power or you just ignore them and it's irrelevant, I think the anti-fascist perspective, which is useful for us to take into consideration, is that in any dose it's dangerous, in any dose it should be organized against, because you can get these local attacks, because far-right groups, even when they don't get into power, can influence broader discourses. We can see the influence of white nationalist politics on the Trump administration, not only through Bannon, but through the creation of the notion that white Christians are the most persecuted group in America, which a lot of people believe for some strange reason. So it's about seeing it in the broader spectrum, seeing the influence these ideas can have, and not just thinking, well, if they're not going to take over the government, then why bother?
How much of the people that you came across, where was the line drawn in terms of what, how much they would use or be willing to use violence as a tactic, right? I mean, because we have the example in Charlottesville where Antifa is credited by members of the clergy, not just Cornel West, but others, with protecting them, with literally protecting their these people's lives who were, sort of more pacifistic protesting. And they stepped in where the police would not. And by all accounts, you know, at the very least, protected them from serious harm. We also have accounts of people going up and randomly punching people they deem to be Nazis. I don't know. There was a story out of last week, or I guess a week or two ago, in Oakland, Reveal News, a guy named Will Carlos. They had been, reporting on some Antifa in the San Francisco Bay Area, and one guy was talking about, we'll go into their houses and we will take them out if we have to. Preemptively. I mean, where are these lines drawn, or is it just an individual thing, or is it just a local group to local group? Where is that line?
Certainly, I can't comment on every single instance, but certainly it's a decentralized politics. It's a politics of autonomous groups, and different groups will, of course, just as really with any autonomous politics, make their own decisions about tactics and context and who to organize against. That's true of any kind of decentralized politics, but of course, especially true in a context like this. Among the people that I spoke to, it was all very contextual. It's different to speak to someone in Greece. I spoke to an organizer of an anti-fascist martial arts tournament there because there had been extensive fascist infiltration into the martial arts scene. So we organized that. Certainly in places like Russia, about a dozen anti-fascists have been murdered over the last decade. So that's different from a place like the Netherlands, where usually guns and knives are not even part of the equation. In the U.S., having a very open gun policy makes the conversation different. It's very contextual, but the people that I spoke to emphasize that if they can stop a white power event simply by making phone calls or writing letters or organizing a boycott, that's always preferable. That in their perspective, when you get a confrontation, to some extent, that's kind of a last resort, where the kind of other methods of stopping far-right organizing by doxing their leaders, trying to disrupt their internal apparatus, have failed. Of course, it's always a subjective thing. It's always a matter of interpretation and context. And, there's not much more to say beyond that. It's a question that also was really hotly debated in the 20s and 30s. At what point does fascism become threatening enough to stand up to it? How should we stand up to it? These are not always clear questions. I think it's important for everyone to grapple with them and not always think about them in terms of absolutes, but think of them contextually based on their communities and their own concerns.
Well, I mean, I guess, I mean, trying to sort of narrow that context, right? Because I think this is where it starts getting trickier for people. Because I think most people, even if they don't identify as Antifa, would probably, I mean, would have no problem. I didn't see, let me put it this way. When people were being ID'd from photos from Charlottesville on Twitter. And, you know, my feeling was I'm a little nervous to engage in that because sometimes you start IDing people improperly. Like, you know, that's Bill McKenzie. And it turns out Bill McKenzie was like, that's not me. And all of a sudden, you know, his garage is burned down or something. But aside from that, okay, but the idea in principle, I don't think most people, you know, would have an issue with that. Identifying people who are out there, you know, in public, having their pictures taken, marching, you know, in support of Confederate monuments. But I think, you know, from there, it starts getting a little bit murkier. And I'm just curious, from the context of the work that you've done within the United States, right, where I think, you know, at least this audience, the vast majority of this audience has a better sense of, like, you know, what you know, of that context. Like, where is that line drawn with most of the Antifa people that you have come across? Like, is it preemptive? Is it preventative? Is it self-defense? I mean, where is that line drawn in terms of violence?
Right. Well, certainly the anti-fascist interpretation of self-defense is broader than what probably many people would espouse. They think of self-defense in an anti-fascist context as not only being in terms of immediate self-defense, but also being preemptive. That's essentially because they don't give fascism or white supremacy the kind of benefit of the doubt of, will this group become violent? Will this group pose a threat to local communities? They essentially assume from the outset, based on the historical record, that these groups, by virtue of existing, pose a danger. And they'll do whatever they think is necessary, not whatever they think, but whatever they think is necessary to try and stop them. And sometimes that will mean confronting groups at demonstrations before they necessarily even do anything, because of the argument that these politics are not just a difference of opinion, but pose a threat. And we can see in different places around the U.S., around the country, that when these groups establish local hubs, violence does follow. And so the argument is that rather than waiting for someone to get beat up and then everyone raises an outcry and marches out, or, you know, you can even see in Charlottesville, it was unfortunate that it took the death of Heather Heyer for so many people to take this seriously. They argue, we know that these things will keep happening, and so in that sense they have a preemptive understanding of self-defense. And that is a political difference that they'll have with a lot of people, but that's how they see it.
And one of the things that's difficult, I guess, about these tactics in this perspective is measuring its success rate. I mean, there was a piece on the National Memo, and here's a quote from it from Lindsay Beierstein. Paramilitaries facing off in the streets is God's gift to fascism. Not everyone likes racism and militarism, but everyone likes safety and order. If we've already got safety and order, fascists have nothing to offer casual supporters. So in other words, when there are images on the television of fascists and anti-fascists fighting, even if it's even if the fascists started it, the inclination is for most people just saying, like, I want just there not to be fighting on my television. Yeah. So I'm willing to give the Trump administration and the local police force more authority to go and arrest all of them. I mean, what's the counter argument to that? And to the extent that we have any data on success of these tactics, what is there?
So there's two points to make. First, I'll look at the sort of 20s, 30s, and 40s, and then I'll look at more recently. So in terms of the older examples, we can see that there was street fighting between fascists and anti-fascists in virtually every country of Europe in the interwar period. What determines whether or not you get fascism is less the violence per se and more the economic conditions and the ability of the traditional elites to project power for the local industrialists or agriculturalists. So in Germany, for example, you do have paramilitary formations and veterans associations across the political spectrum from the end of World War I onward. The Nazis didn't actually start to gain power until after the Depression And at the same time that they gained power or gained support, so did the Communist Party. So simply saying that violence produces it is kind of missing the exact context, because you also have even more fascists numerically in France at the same time. You have similar kinds of conflicts, but the French state managed to maintain control, the economy did better, and you don't get fascism. In terms of recent examples, we can look at, you know, the destruction, the stopping of the National Front in Britain, the successes of the anti-fascist movement in Norway in the 1990s, the success of the Jewish anti-fascist veterans organization, the 43 group of the 1940s. There are a number of examples of this working. It works best when it starts on groups that are small and are rising rather than mass parties. So, you know, I think that certainly there came a point, right, in the 30s and 40s when popular self-defense was legitimate. We may disagree on when that point was, but to say that it's never legitimate or that it always is counterproductive is, I think, not borne out by the historical evidence.
And so with just in the past couple of weeks since Charlottesville, Bannon's gone, Gorka's gone, and a bunch of other, frankly, Trump sycophants are gone from the White House, names we may not be as familiar with. Certainly, in the weeks leading up to that, some of the other sort of people, a couple of the guys on the National Security Council who were writing these treaties that were rather disturbing to the president, they're gone. Is that, I mean, what would be an Antifa perspective on that, on the exit of those people from the administration, A, and then B, what would be the perspective of just the Democrats making a deal with Trump? I mean, does the perspective get that broad, that 30,000 foot for Antifa, or is it more localized?
Well, So what does it mean that these people are out? I think that it would mean something more if Trump weren't also at the same time repealing DACA and, you know, saying that there are good people who are participating in the White Power Tiki March. It's kind of hard to really, I think, draw firm conclusions about what Trump and his administration are doing. It's so chaotic that I'm hesitant to venture a really strong statement on that. But in terms of sort of how anti-fascists view it, it's certainly traditionally and present day, Antifa is more focused on local and regional organizing, the day-to-day nitty-gritty of who these people are and what they're doing. Now, in that sense, that Antifa can be understood as sort of only one facet of a larger left opposition to racism and fascism. And I think that really we can see that at a certain point, if you really want to push back against these forces as a whole, you need a strong left. You need to provide people with the kinds of things they need that when they don't receive, they turn to the far right. And in that sense, Antifa is sort of, some people I've spoken to have likened it to sort of a firefighting brigade to deal with immediate outbreaks of the far right and try and put them out. It's not necessarily a politics to sort of overhaul society and make people immune to the appeal of fascism and white supremacy. For the most part, as we've said, anti-fascists are, in the United States especially, are anarchists, and therefore are less focused on what politicians do with their sort of inner workings and cabinets. So that's, you know, it's a slightly different perspective. But that's sort of, I think, how we can see it relating to the larger politics.
Well, I mean, would the fall of Milo Yiannopoulos, would that be perceived as an Antifa victory?
For some people, sure, yeah. I mean, that was sort of a self-inflicted wound in part, but sure.
Interesting. I guess that's about it. I mean, so where do you think it goes from here? I mean, is this is a movement that's obviously grown or a perspective? I mean, it has grown, it seems to me. I mean, you could probably track it. I don't know if it's possible to do this, but theoretically it would be possible to track it relative to the inverse of like what the Southern Poverty Law Center data has, right? I mean, that the more go ahead.
Yeah, to some extent that's true. I mean, I interviewed people who are part of anti-fascist groups who were active back in 2008, 2009, and they told me stories about the challenges they faced trying to convince even radical leftists that monitoring, you know, groups of a dozen neo-Nazis online was an important use of time. Today, that is much more accepted in the broader left and beyond. A lot of the groups I interviewed formed in 2015 or 2016 in places like Nebraska or Indiana or Sacramento, and that was clearly in response to the Trump campaign, accelerated by his victory. And so the broader trajectory that we can see by analyzing Antifa over the past several decades in multiple countries is the rise and fall of these groups and these movements is almost always dependent on the fortunes of the far right. So it's possible, and I cross my fingers, that, you know, in 5 or 7 years, the fortunes of the alt-right will decline. These groups will be scattered. They'll return to behind their computer screens. Leftists will focus on whatever the unfortunate tragedy of the day is or issue, whether it's climate change or what have you, and this will be less of an issue. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and it's certainly, I think, incredibly misunderstood in our popular discourse. Mark Bray, the book is Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, folks. Head into our fun app. We will obviously put a link, that book, to on the majority.fm site. Which we're going to be updating soon, too. 2 weeks.
Wow.
Well, not 2 weeks, but I just, it was like.
It's
it was
Trump,
like,
Trump 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Oh, 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
We'll see 2 weeks.
I think many people want to solve that.
There was a multitude of, like, I've seen like a multitude now of 2 week compilations with Trump. It's a lot of stuff. It's the, like, the FU, which was the Freedmen Unit.
It is the time that it feels like less pressing when something's 2 weeks out. It's like, yeah.
There has to be a science to that. I mean, not that he's done the research, but I think he has over the years probably just like, yeah, we'll get that within 2 weeks. So it's like not so urgent that it's the end of the week, but it's not like this is not open-ended. We're going to wrap this up. Before the end of the month.
I got a weekend.
Yeah, before the... Exactly. We're going to do some of the work in the first week. Then we're going to think about it on the weekend. And then we're going to wrap it up.
The whole time we were thinking about it.
We were thinking about it.
The whole time it was in mind.
Folks, look. Don't be like Donald Trump. Don't wait 2 weeks to join the Majority Report. Support this show. Shit.
I'll join in 2 weeks.
I'll join in 2 weeks.
We'll join in 2 weeks.
Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Reminder, tomorrow is Kelly's final day in the office. Although she said to me, yeah, like 2 days ago, like, is it all right if I work out of this office? I'm like, what?
Gonna miss it.
She's gonna work. She's gonna work on a different show here. It's crazy. So, at the very least, become a member. Support us getting a new desk. We're like a work share place now. Also, tomorrow not only is Kelly's final day on the program, supposedly. But we are starting early, sometime around 11 a.m., maybe like 5 of 11, because we got to end it early. And we have a special Kelly request for the ostensible film review guy. But it's not, you know, we never get film reviews. Well, now I just gave it away that it's not Matthew Film Guy. Although, is that a surprise? No. So... Folks, become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Or have you checked out Jet yet? Jet.com? You can get our link at majorityreportkickback.com and buy your jet.com stuff. I don't know how it goes price by price, but it's in instances I know I've saved money via Jet. So check it out. All right, quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your phone calls in the fun half. All the time she said no, 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 no. Like to speak my mind, she said no, 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 no. And I know her time's not free. She didn't waste none on me. Situation sad. Situation sad.